right, this is a show we're going to do today that we've been talking about doing for a few months now, and we knew we wanted to do it. We knew it was an important show to do. We're having a hard time figuring out how to do it. I hope we did figure that out today. I think we did, and I think you're about to find that out. And, you know, the focus of the show really is on young African-American men who are disproportionately at risk for unemployment, for poverty, for being either the victims of or perpetrators of violence, for incarceration, for myriad social and economic problems. They are at disproportionate risk compared to everybody else. So, you know, the questions obviously are, why is that and what do we do about it? And those are both huge questions. And there are attempts being made to address those questions all the time. You may have seen that President Obama recently rolled out a fairly big program addressing exactly that question. I say fairly big. It's $200 million. It's like three minor league baseball stadiums, it turns out. So that's not going to necessarily fix anything overnight. But it's something anyway. $200 million, a five-year commitment on that. We wanted to sort of go a little smaller and more personal and look at that throughout the actual stories of people around us. But the other thing that we were really intrigued by, we're also looking for a way to respond to Ta-Nehisi Coates' landmark piece of journalism in The Atlantic within the last month or so called The Case for Reparations, which really essentially makes the same argument that society has been broken pretty much for the entire existence of the United States of America, and certainly very little got fixed post-Civil War and even post-Jim Crow, that there were still structural inequities in this system that contributed to and continue to contribute to the exact phenomenon that I just described to you. So anyway, how do we talk about this? Well, we're going to talk about it. We've got four guests in studio with us. We do hope that you also will feel free to call in as we go along. The number is 860-275-7266. Also, you may tweet us and may tweet about us at WNPR Colin. I'm going to ask you, I don't usually do hashtags, I'm going to ask you if you're tweeting about this today to use the hashtag YMOC, Young Men of Color, because that's actually one of the places on Twitter that this debate is taking place, so through that hashtag. So David Canton is with us. He's an associate professor of history at Connecticut College. Eric Clemens is the president and CEO of Connecticut Center for Arts and Technologies, CONCAT, in New Haven. Shay Dawson is a school administrator and youth advocate in New Haven. Omar Downer is a graduate of CONCAT and a phlebotomist at the Yale New Haven Hospital. So you guys could have cooperated. He had to have blood drawn today, and you're a phlebotomist. I just put that together. We could have saved you a whole trip, you know. Let's talk. And so, Eric Clemens, I'm going to ask you to sort of begin things. But first of all, explain what CONCAT is.
Yeah. First, I want to say thank you, Colin, for having us on, and my colleagues here for having the courage to have this conversation that I think needs to be had, for the most part, in the Black communities. What CONCAT is three parts. One is adult job training for unemployed, underemployed adults who are living in and around New Haven and who are living for the most part in poverty. Second part of CONCAT is our youth arts programming, where we use the arts as a vehicle for academic achievement. And the third part is our entrepreneurial academy, where we have partnered with Quinnipiac School of Business, teaching young high school students entrepreneurship. This conversation came about because I was thinking about retention of our adult job training students. And what I was noticing was 90% of the men who entered into the program didn't last a month. We do phlebotomy, medical coding, and 90% of the men, 85 to 90% of the trainees are African-American. 100% of those men were African-American, and 90% of those didn't last a month. And I thought it was maybe the trainings that we chose, because we partnered with Yale New Haven Hospital. We designed programs based on Yale New Haven Hospital's needs. And I realized it was a deeper issue. It was a much more complex issue than the trainings. And what I did was went around the community and had conversations with men about Black men. And what we did was had a roundtable discussion with Black men from various parts of life, some as Shay Dawson is a high school principal, another was a VP at the Community Foundation, and others were folks who had been selling drugs and were incarcerated and now have done good for themselves. And we centered the conversation around Omar, who you'll hear from soon, who was a trainee at Concat who had also quit. And I had a long conversation with Omar as well as my other team members and talked about the idea and the power of finishing, right? What is it that made Omar quit and quit easily? What is it that made the black men who entered into our program just check out? And so Omar finally chose to come back to the program. He completed the program, is one of our first cohorts of phlebotomy cohorts, and now is an employee of Yano Haven Hospital. So what is it about Omar that is different than the other men?
You know, in just a second, we're going to ask Omar that. But mm-hmm. I'm going to ask Shay that question, too, or ask it a different way. Look, there's a record unemployment these days. There are diminished opportunities for all kinds of people. And as we're suggesting, the opportunities for young men of color are even more diminished. Why wouldn't it be the case that Eric's biggest problem would be like adding security as he's stampeded by young men of color wanting to get into this program and stay in this program? I mean, in some ways, it seems like it ought to be a layup, right? To come out of this as a phlebotomist or any of the other options just seems like it ought to be something an awful lot of young black men would want. Why would it be otherwise?
I think Eric alluded to it earlier. It's really about the vision that young men have for themselves, right? And so you cannot, the stampede doesn't start if you can't see yourself becoming a phlebotomist, if that standard hasn't been set for you. And so I think the challenges begin around the vision and the standard and expectations that we have for ourselves and for each other. And so I think that's one among many challenges in terms of, not just becoming a phlebotomist, but, I mean, you can name the occupations or the academies or universities. I think that's where it starts.
All right, Omar, let's hear from you. You got into the program. You dropped out of the program. You came back. What? First of all, let's just talk about why you dropped for a while. What caused that?
I dropped out because mainly my fellow students weren't respecting me. They weren't treating me with the dignity that I thought a program should be treated with. And Mr. Clemens has made it a safe area for everybody, and I didn't feel as safe in the area with everybody because we're all from the same neighborhood. We are all there, and, you know, we love each other, but sometimes we weren't getting along.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel like they respected the discipline that I had, the commitment, the courage, and the resolve, and I walked away from it. But Mr. Clemens said, Eddie Talk spoke to me, said, you never trust a man who can't finish. And that brought me back to figure out if I started this, I can finish it. And now it's my passion. I love getting up in the morning, going to work. I like going to work at nights when I have to. And it's just brought a lot of joy to me. And it's just something I could spend my time studying and refining. So it's been a great help in my life. It's brought me into manhood. And that's one of the major things that the program did for me.
So, Eric, Omar is basically saying that he dropped for a while not because he was less serious about the program, but because he was more serious about the program than the other people in the program. Does it seem right to you?
Yeah. I think what Omar experienced was an influx, that's the stampede that you talk about, of folks who enter into a program and aren't ready for the expectation and the standards of that program. And Omar obviously was. And so it took us maybe a month for those expectations, those values and standards to really kick into folks and let them understand that this is a very serious program, and it's rigorous. Mm-hmm. It's very rigorous. And because of that, Omar, I think, met some challenges with his peers. And again, and as he said, when he and I talked, the one thing that I impressed upon him was you cannot trust a man who does not finish things. And I think he took that to heart and came back to the program. But it was very tough in the beginning to get people and this is another layer of the issue, right? The expectations and the standards that Shay talked about, alluded to earlier. How do we set those standards and expectations and have people abide by them and thereby rising up to the occasion? Omar definitely rose to the occasion. But again, as I stated in my opening, a lot do not.
I just want to get you to say a little bit more about the conversations you had. You know, you talked about sort of convening this round table of people with, first of all, different backgrounds and different outcomes, too, in life. Did you learn you must have learned, larger truths than the ones we're talking about here. In other words, there are things about Omar's case that are specific to Omar, specific to your program. But in terms of ways in which the deck is stacked and ways in which the deck can be unstacked and made more even, what came out of those conversations?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what I have to do is point out also, I want to thank Cynthia Farrar and Lisa Shapiro of Purple States for taping and videoing that conversation that we had. And what came out of that, we had about 6 to 7 black men, again, from various parts of life. Omar was the central piece. And what came out of that conversation was this idea of resilience and commitment in the face of opposition, right? What is it about myself coming from the same stuff that our trainees are coming from, being poor, single mother, was limited in terms of education early on in my life? What was it about me that allowed me to break through that and have some sense of, and practice some sense of resilience and commitment in the midst of systemic pressures and opposition? You know, what was it about Shay and what was it about all those men who have done well for themselves presently? But what was it about them in their life, and how did they navigate those issues, those things that are holding black men back, or are they holding themselves back? Because a lot of it is really kind of psychic conversion, right? How do I think about myself differently in the midst of things that are not conducive to my success? And those were pearls for me as I listened to Shay and others talk about their life experience.
You know, David Canton, I want to draw you into this conversation, too. Obviously, as I'm listening to stories like this and thinking about even President Obama's initiative, it's a better world if these kinds of personal initiatives work, if people get mentors through the Obama program or if people get training. You know, it's a better world where Omar is a phlebotomist than where he's not and he doesn't really have any prospects. Also, reading the Ta-Nehisi Coates article, I'm realizing there's a huge structural problem or set of problems. And I'm wondering how much programs like the one we're talking about here that are based on personal solutions and personal initiatives can really address what we're talking about today.
That's a good question. The work that's being done by CONCAT, these other programs are great. What question are we going to ask, right? So we have an individual, Brother Omar, who's done well, got through the program, persevered. We look at it from a structural perspective, according like the Coates article, even with a black president, we still see have 2 times unemployment. Black men with college degrees are still 2 times unemployed, white men with college degrees. So I think the structural argument in terms of is the question that we have to ask. How do we impact the structure? So when President Obama gave the commencement address at my where I graduated from Morehouse College, he himself did not make that statistical reality. So what are the questions? Why do we have this double-digit unemployment rate? So as a historian, I put that in context. I mean, people don't realize that African Americans have spent more times in slavery, 224, than free, 149 years. We also see that we talk about this reparations. There's been a long list of reparations literature. In 1880, a woman by the name of Callie House organized a pension for ex-slaves and tried to get money for these women who had to work till they died because there was no money for them. James Forman, a member of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, in May 17, 1969, at the American Baptist Convention, demanded $500 million for reparations. Boris Bitker, Yale law professor, 1973, wrote a book, The Case for Black Reparations. 1987, the National Coalition for Black Reparations, an organization. And, of course, Randall Robinson's piece in 2001, The Debt. So there was this conversation, and after 9/11, it kind of fell off the table. So Mr. Coates' work is in the tradition saying that there's a long structural inequality that African-Americans encounter. When we look at poverty, there are more poor whites, 18 million, than poor blacks, 9 million. However, African-Americans win the numbers battle, but we lose at the percentage war, and I think that's where the confusion comes in. So there are more white people on welfare, more white people on these quote-unquote entitlement programs, but blacks are disproportionately on these programs. So my argument is, how do we bring this structural debate to mainstream culture? Because the self-help initiatives are great, but we're still asking the same questions 50 years from now. So I think it's never an either-or, but in order to change the structure, you need a social movement. The civil rights movement made that impact. If you look at black poverty rates, 1960, 60%. 10 years later, now 30% because of the social movement. So I think we have to sit down, have these conversations, and this reparation is a great discussion. Not saying eliminate individualist programs, but how do we keep this discussion up, turn it to a movement, and really address these structural inequalities that African Americans encounter?
You know, Shea Dawson, as a school administrator, you see a lot of young black men. And I'm feeling like Omar's story is a little bit of an outlier, just in the sense that, he was struggling in the program, as we said, not because he wasn't serious enough about it, because he was too serious, didn't feel the other people in the program were serious enough and respectful enough of him and of the program. And so, Eric, you can correct me if I'm wrong about that, but I'm guessing that the typical person who quits this program quits for a different reason, quits because they can't see the outcome, they can't picture the outcome, they are the kind of person that Omar's talking about, can't get serious enough about the program. So picture somebody like that. Picture somebody who doesn't stay with a program like CONCAT. What's the outcome? What happens to that person? I mean, I know it's not one single outcome, but I mean, where does your mind go when I describe that?
I think first I would want to just talk about the Omar issue, because it's actually not that rare, right? Mm-hmm. It is not such an outlier. If you look at it just from Omar's perspective, maybe. But if you look at what he's talking about, which was the culture of the group that he was a part of, right? And I think that is common, where it's not only do I not see myself finishing, or I don't see a future for myself in this, but those who do, that's so rare in this group that I'm going to give them a hard time about it. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I think that shouldn't go unnoticed. But as a school administrator and looking at the outcomes of this, I think we can all think of these sort of really tragic stories, but that's really a small percentage. I think the large percentage of folks end up underprepared, right, and live in households or communities that are under-resourced. And when you have that, I think it turns into not only a sort of a life of poverty or a life of underachieving, but we put that hurt and that pain on others, right? And that can be manifested in different ways. And so I think that's the challenge, right? The challenge is that you grow physically as an adult, but you don't mature and achieve your potential. And I think that as a school administrator, as a parent, as a neighbor, that's the worst thing that you want for yourself or for your children, for them to underachieve.
Omar Downer, what made you the person that you are right now, who was serious enough to come back to the program and make sure that you complete it? Obviously, it's a great thing that Eric Clements and CONCAT were there. But what else was there for you that made you serious enough about it, where maybe somebody else wouldn't have been? What was it? Church? Was it family? Was it who shaped you into the person who entered that program?
It's a combination of my mother, my stepfather, my sister. My mentors, the people who I've met. When I went to CONCAT, I felt like it was a paradigm shift for me. It was a new place, a new opportunity. I was in a place where I was laid off and I needed a new career, and I wanted a four-way into the medical field. And I felt like this was a great opportunity that was presented to me, and I had to jump on it as quick as possible and bring all the things that I've learned from my discipline, my resolve, my dedication, and my work ethic. Those were things that I had previously, and I brought those to CONCAT, and they magnify them. They have made me, like I said, into a man now. I'm no longer a boy. I've reached full manhood now. I understand about employment. I understand about life, about you gotta finish. You always gotta finish strong. You might start slow, but you always gotta finish strong. You gotta start something and see all the way to the end.
Let me grab one call here. We're gonna take a break pretty soon and come back with more. But here's David in Simsbury. Hi, David.
Hello.
You're on the air.
Okay, I would just like to this is almost expanding on Shea Dawson and Omar, I think their names are. But I want to talk about more of a psychological perspective and that learned helplessness. You sometimes hear that phrase. Well, African Americans have been discriminated against for so long. But I think they've kind of internalized this, where they're growing up in neighborhoods with a lot of crime. They're growing up in neighborhoods where there are a lot of drugs. They have families that have not achieved, a college education. They are not doing that well. I'm wondering if, and they can feel free to correct me, whether this people are just almost hopeless. They feel like that's not a future that's available to them. So kind of like, I'm almost wondering whether they feel like, why would I bother?
I bet everybody in the room has some kind of response to that. I don't know. David, do you want to start out with that?
Well, again, it's not, again, these issues, poverty is not just black. It's internalized, these stereotypes internalized by African Americans, by whites, by Americans in general. The reality is more black people graduate from college now than ever, and all statistics show that. So in terms of internalizing helplessness, it's more complicated than that. We live in a structure, white supremacist, a racist structure, that's internalized by all Americans. So therefore, in terms of the question should be, how do we again address that structural inequality? In that most African Americans want to work, do well like any other Americans, but it's these barriers, and they haven't been internalized because there's always been perseverance fighting through it. So really the question is, what can we do as all citizens to make opportunity equal for everyone? And this whole notion about blacks facing extra crime or African Americans have these extra obstacles, we see that, again, like I said before, these issues are internalized by a lot of Americans. We have to come together and make real solutions and then dispel the myths that exist that create these divisions.
Let me just press you on that a little bit, all right? Because and then we will go to break. But so there's a lot of people listening saying, well, on the other hand, I'm listening to four success stories right now, and we have the ultimate success story in front of our eyes every day. Their names are Barack and Michelle. That if there can be somebody like anybody in this room, some people will listen to that and say, well, then maybe there aren't such barriers. Just as you were talking at the beginning of your comments about, you know, rising college graduation rates among African Americans. So if you were going to talk to that person who's saying, well, it really does look like there's a, you know, pretty good stepladder here. What's the big problem, David? What would you say?
Well, of course, there's been progress. There's no way I'd rather live in 1950 than 2014. So compared relative to African Americans, there's been problems. But when we talk about these gaps, wealth gap, education gap, income, infant mortality, these are structural issues. Here's another example. Blacks have owned 1% of this nation's wealth in 1865. They still only own 1% of the nation's wealth in spite of Obama, Oprah Winfrey, and these four or five Jay-Z, Dr. Dre billionaires. So these are really structural issues that predicate itself when we talk about white privilege. That's another conversation. In terms of we have a system that benefits whites. And again, people, it's not personal, it's how systems work. That being white, there's an unfair advantage. Ira Katznelson's When Affirmative Action Was White talks about this. And we talk about housing, education, which is all connected on the other side, that these have connections to resources and access. And, you know, getting jobs is through networks and who you know. But with a extremely segregated nation, right, and whites have a majority of power, how do you get access to these institutions when you have these type of inequalities?
Eric, and then we'll go to break.
Really quick, and to Brother David's point, and also the caller, David, you know, what's important is, and I'll bring us back to why I was really going around the community having this conversation, is what is it about black women in CONCAT's program that rise to the occasion, that speak to the standards and the expectations and the rigor of the program? And what is it about black men who don't, right? That to me is really the essential question. And those structural things that are in place that don't allow for black folks to the majority of black folks to succeed. What is that? What are those things, and how do we navigate those things? And why do black women navigate them a bit better than black men? So really, I really want to grapple with that more after break.
All right, quick follow up from David, just so he doesn't lose his train of
thought. Well, we know in this culture that as for women, regardless of race, that education is the key to a good income and benefits. So therefore, we know statistically only 18% of African Americans graduate from college, 30% are white. So most people don't graduate from college. But we know single women with no degrees will definitely be in poverty. And we know we have divorced families that usually women take care of the kids. So women have to have these extended education opportunities in order to get a middle-class lifestyle. For a lot of men, there's construction, there's longshoremen jobs. You can still use your physical body, but we see even those jobs are being closed down because how we take advantage of undocumented workers. So definitely, I think in our culture for women, I think how we socialize girls, right? Girls should do well in schools, and boys being boys mean they'll get it at 25, 35, 45. They may never get it, but they're good boys. They can fight and play sports. But girls have to keep their room clean and study, and we reinforce these gender expectations on our young girls and our boys.
All right. I think we have a young woman who was going to want to comment right after the break, Latasha from West Hartford. On the line right now, our number, 860-275-7266. We got a lot of ground to cover, 860-275-7266. You can join a conversation with our tweet master, Greg Hill, at WNPR Colin. Try to use that hashtag, YMOC, Young Men of Color.
To even the toughest among us, that would be too much. Didn't know what it was to be black till they gave him his change. They didn't want to touch his hand. To even the toughest among us, don't you know that would be too.
We're talking about the problems, the specific challenges that face young men of color, young African-American men in our society, more susceptible, I mean, by far and disproportionately susceptible to unemployment, underemployment, poverty, incarceration, and being either the victims or perpetrators of violence. You know that whole story, I think, or I hope you do. And so how do we address that? What do we do about it? Why is it happening in the first place? I'm going to go to a phone call in just a second here, but, Eric and David, I had another thought. You were talking about sort of the different kind of outcome pattern for young men versus young women. Another difference between young men, between men and women is, you see it all across your life, like the whole difficulty that men have asking for directions if they're lost in their car, whereas women can do it. Women are much better at asking questions. I've been spending a lot of time with a young African-American woman right now who's she asks a lot of questions. If she's in a situation that she doesn't understand, she asks questions about it until she understands it. And men, whether they're black or white or whatever color they are, men don't like to ask questions. They don't like to admit, their own insecurity in a situation like that. And I think as you begin to sort of suss out the landscape that you're trying to conquer, whether it's networking or any of the other things you talked about, asking questions is really important. And guys are not good at it, no matter what color they are. All right, let's go to a phone call from Latasha in West Hartford. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Listen, I was listening to the previous caller, and I feel like he was shot down with his comment, because I agree with the whole psychological structure of the black male. But what I really think the problem is the structure of the family. We have our families being torn apart, or are torn apart. There's no man, there's no father figure in the household. Now I heard someone say something about it's a whole, a lot of people are in poverty, white, it doesn't matter. But what we're talking about are the blacks. So, we can't put everyone into this conversation. We're talking about the black males, and they're struggling because the family units are broken up. These women living in poverty, themselves, have come from families who have been just torn apart. And this is putting a bad, it's psychologically damaging the males. And then in society, in the crimes and the trouble that they get into, this is becoming a way of life for them.
I think it's a great point. I'll throw it out there. Although, once again, Shea Dawson, as a school administrator, you see a lot of family patterns. What's your reaction to the family pattern that she's describing right now?
I can't argue with her. I think she brings up an extremely valid point around family and the condition of family. But I would say, as I'm sure the historian here on the panel would say, that it's not just black families. The American family is breaking down. But I would also want to add, and I would love to hear some of the fellow panelists speak to this issue of, I believe the breakdown in the family is a byproduct of other things, right? And some of it is the history in this country. but also a society that we're sort of self-perpetuating sort of negative aspects of family, negative aspects of women through pop culture. And traditionally or historically, that had never been a part of the Black family. And once we have incorporated that way of life, a sort of a disrespect for our elders and a disrespect for wisdom, I think some of the values that we once held dearly have fallen by the wayside.
You know, I mean, in some ways, her question and her comment leads into a critique that we hear a lot. We hear it from both white leaders and Black leaders. And it's, you know, it's the Mayor Michael Nutter critique. It's the Bill Cosby critique. It's the critique. You're making your own hell that you have to live in, right? The mayor of Philadelphia basically said, pull up your pants, buy a belt, and stop making babies that you're not going to raise. And so that's a critique that comes from within the community. And so, Eric, I see you nodding, you recognizing that critique.
I
anyway,
do.
How do you react to it?
Yeah, I agree. Was it Latasha? I agree with Latasha, and I think it's something, as it relates to Black families and Black fathers especially, it's a conversation that needs to be had that is never had, right? I believe that the issue of truant Black fathers has decimated the Black community. I believe that we need to have a conversation, and not even a solution-based conversation. If President Obama and his Brother's Keeper initiative is funneling money to mostly Black and Latino communities, and those communities haven't had a real robust, penetrating conversation about the issues in the community, then I don't know if the money will do any good. We have to be prepared, and being prepared is having the very courageous, tough conversations about what is wrong with our Black communities. And I would say, number one is not the one problem. Number one problem is not having the conversation. The number two problem is the truancy of Black fathers in the Black family. Absolutely. I think Latasha is absolutely dead correct.
I'm going to take some more calls here, but, you know, I guess one thing I want to do, I want to go over to Omar Downer for a second. First of all, I should reintroduce the panel here. David Canton, Associate Professor of History at Kahn College. Eric Clements is the president and CEO of the Connecticut Center for Arts and Technology, CONCAT, a program we're talking about here, which in fact does provide training and certification opportunities for people to get jobs. Shay Dawson is a school administrator, youth advocate in New Haven. Omar Downer, a graduate of CONCAT and a phlebotomist at Yale New Haven Hospital. You know, in some ways, I think maybe a mistake I'm making, Omar, is thinking as though, well, your life is basically settled. You know, you get to be a phlebotomist, boom, you know, it's all done. You're all set. I mean, obviously, you have a whole other series of hurdles to clear, whether it's getting a mortgage or, you know, any of the other things that are involved in setting up a life, the good life that you now want for yourself and think you can absolutely have. Do you see structural barriers ahead of you still? I mean, do you feel as though getting the job and having a vision for yourself, does that settle all your problems? Or do you see other, you know, as David would say, structural issues ahead of you?
I do see a lot of other structural issues ahead of me, but at the same time, I have to take my time and work on my goals. One of my goals in the future is to go to college. I want a college education. I want to be able to help people in my community. I love the way Mr. Clemens took his time to set the school up so that we can come there. And that gives me an opportunity to see other people at work, and it makes me want to do more for myself and to help other people because I want to pay it forward. I just don't want to come and just get it and just say, okay, I'm set, that's me, and forget about everybody else. We are a community, and we got to work together to get where we want to go. My life is not structured in there where I am financially secure. Those are things that I want to work on. I want to be able to travel the world. And these are things that a lot of inner-city kids never get to go outside of inner city and see the world. I personally am Jamaican, so I'm from Jamaica. I've seen the difference between America and Jamaica, and I have both culture, and I love having both of them because I've seen that, and I've grown up in both of them, and it's made me a far better person.
Let me grab – somebody want to react to that? Yeah, okay.
I want to get back to the family issue. There's a stat that came out that Black fathers married unmarried spend more time with the kids than any other racial group in this country. Mm-hmm. So there's, again, a lot of misinformation that comes out here. And this whole thing, when you study a society, you have to do these comparisons. That's how you know there's inequality. So we know that African-American men spend more time with their kids, married, even ones who are not married. And then President Bush had a program where let's put poor parents together, to be together. But if they hate one another, how is that good for the child? What's good for the child is two working parents with livable wages and income. So while we look at these self-help, we don't talk about the economic realities. We're in a capitalist country. When you have not a lot of resources, it's tough being a parent. So therefore, for middle-class parents to get divorced all the time, they both have checks, income, and benefits, it's not a problem. But when you're poor, that becomes the issue. So it's hard to figure out someone's intrinsic psychological, but I do know one thing. If you don't have any money, it's hard to raise a family. So we need to start looking at raising wages. We know in industrial era, working class guys got a job just right out of high school, worked in a Chrysler plant, $40,000. We know marriage rates, regardless of race, 50% in this country. So these aren't uniquely African-American issues. So we have to, let's dispel this myth. Black men are involved in their families. Now, of course, I know someone who knows somebody that knows someone who's not, but it's much more complicated. And I think it's definitely linked to a lot of couples co-parent. If both parents have livable wage employment, I guarantee things work out better than when you have one person working at Walmart, another unemployed, makes it very complicated, very, very difficult to be great parents.
Let's grab a call from Valentina in Hartford. Hi, you're on the air. Well, you could be on the air anyway. Valentina, you there? We'll try another one. Here's Gregory in West Haven. Hi, Gregory.
Hi there. Thanks so much for doing this. Listen, there's great discussion here about what we need in terms of fundamental policy shifts. We need more jobs. We need higher wages. We need better education in the Black community. But we need a more fair judicial system and to stop the inequality in the incarceration rates. But why are all these things happening? And why have we absolutely known the solutions to them for 20 years and the policy changes do not happen? We can't keep talking about, well, we need to change this policy and this attitude and that attitude and then thinking that overnight something's going to be different when we've known this stuff for so long and it doesn't change. That's the question we need to be asking. You had a caller who talked about learned hopelessness. I think this is the real learned hopelessness, that we are unwilling to address the real fundamental issues about why what we know will not get implemented. What are the interests? Follow the money.
David's got a response.
I can be optimistic. That's why we need a social movement. The civil rights movement addressed these issues. No one sat around and said, well, segregation will be here forever. Let's do something about it. If you look at Seattle, they have a $15 an hour movement where that's their minimum wage the next couple of years. So in terms of making a movement, and it's not just, again, a Black problem. We have to educate whites. 86% of whites go to schools that are 90% white. Therefore, they don't celebrate Black History Month because they think that's just a Black thing. So if we educate all Americans about justice and wages and unequal and inequality, then it becomes a more radical movement. We find this country, the most radical movements are when they're interracial, in spite of some of the contradictions, the populist movement, we find civil rights movement, when progressive Blacks and whites, even though it's not ideal, come together, that's when we're most progressive and you have social change. Instead of having these isolated, whether it's environmental movement, the gun violence versus gun control, which has been racialized, when we come together, that's when you have policy change. Policy change creates structural change.
Just so we're not talking about abstractions here, and sometimes it's easy to do that, start talking about policy change, start talking about structural barriers and stuff like that. I have this thing I call the magic wand question, where I'm going to give each one of you a magic wand. And it's not totally magic. You can't, completely change reality. But you can get through one change that you want. You can get it through Congress, or you can get it signed by the president or by the governor, or you can, restructure one part of society that is realistically and theoretically restructurable. I'm going to ask each one of you for a specific example of that. What would you do if I handed you that magic wand? And then I'll just go around the table here.
Well, my mom restructured American education. I mean, in terms of how we know SAT scores are linked to income, that we talk about equal opportunity should be equal of conditions in terms of our education system, because we know in the classroom is where we have these discussions from different perspectives, and that when one is educated, they can engage in these conversations intelligently and not how we see in today's society with our talk show culture. Yes versus no, and now we don't understand the nuance, understand these discussions. So for me, education from K all the way through college needs to be reformed, needs to be more engaging, more diverse in terms of perspective, African women in the classrooms, Latinos. And then that's the best way we can lead to have some sort of change. When we have a different mindset, different values, what we value in this country, all that comes through education.
All right, Eric, I'm going to hand you the crazy glue. You can fix one thing that's broken.
I would say what I said earlier, the psychic conversion of black people who feel because of structural racism, because of their experience in living in poverty, this myth of black inferiority, mm-hmm. I would change that to get people to believe that or create a situation and environment where the facilitation of black folks' dreams who are living in poverty are facilitated.
And you know, as a practical matter, I mean, it does sound like mentoring is part of that. You know, I mean, if you had to sort of pick a realistic, I mean, the problem is so many people need mentors on that subject, right? Mm-hmm. So many people need mentors who can convince them that they're not inferior, they're not helpless, that and they're not hopeless.
Well, also, Colin, really quickly, I know you want to give the wand to Shay.
Yeah.
That's why I'm not a big advocate, as I know Brother David here is. I'm not a big advocate of system change. I believe that we can. I believe that you can change the world one person at a time, and by doing so, really working with them and mentoring and spending time and cultivating relationships with people. I don't believe a system can change people.
All right, Shay Dawson, you're next.
I actually agree with both David and Eric. I think both have to happen, and working in the school system. I believe in education is where it starts. I think that's the vehicle, the way the country is designed. But if I had to add an additional thing, it would be around the distribution of wealth, right? Whether it be property, the ability to start businesses. I think that's a major tool in this country is used to for people to advance. And so providing more opportunity for not only for owning property, but also starting businesses. Allowing people to do that for themselves, I think that's something I would fix.
All right. Omar, you got the crazy glue, the magic wand, in your case, maybe the magic needle for blood drawing. So what are you going to do with it?
First, the society that we live in is an instant gratification society where everybody wants everything now, fast food, fast cars. It's not time to slow down, to bring the family together and a family unit, have family time. It's not – people are not – we're not connecting with each other anymore, and we need to bring back the family, and we need to stop wanting everything right here, right now. Everything takes time. You have to plant your seed, you have to cultivate, and then you have the harvest. You can't have one without the other. I think a lot of people just want right now, right here. That's the term, right now. We need to slow ourselves down and get to a point where we're willing to work for where we want to go. The system is here. It might not change, but we can change ourselves. And we have to work on ourselves. We have to take a look in ourselves and look in the mirror first before we can change anybody else. And a lot of people don't want to take the time to do that.
Mm-hmm. That's great. All right. We got to take that break. I really kind of screwed up the clock here. But we will have some time for some calls. If you want to call 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. We'll talk when we get back.
Get that on your record. Employer's going to check it. Fire you. So now you've got to resort to the only method. Let's see the guarantee. Any sense of clarity. When the rent will be paid, the street salary, you're sure to meet tragedy, die, go to jail with some how, you all still seem worth it, and that's real, wishing for the day you can say it's your last deal, but you know you'll be betrayed like Jesus at his last meal, that's
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our intern is Katie Pikus. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin, and Katie Tularski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Spike Lee. For show pages, articles, and pictures, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, how A.R. Gurney and other writers tell their stories through letters. And now, back to Colin.
And the topic of the show today sort of is hashtag YMOC, Young Men of Color. How, in fact, we help this cohort of young men of color face an unusual set of challenges. We've talked a lot about what those challenges really are. You know, Shay Dawson, I want to kind of build on what Omar was talking about there too, because one of the things I think that we tend to think, if we are hopeful and optimistic people, is that there's a steady line of progress and that every single social institution and governmental institution which can buttress and help young men of color is not only steady and stable but actually getting better. And I'm wondering if that's really true. And I think even of – I mean, I started as a newspaper reporter in Hartford in the 1970s. I feel like as I went in through the cities, the churches were bigger and stronger than they are now. Are there things – that can help young men of color that aren't working as well as they did even 30 years ago?
Of course. I don't think there's a particular one. Mm-hmm. I think it depends on the person. But I think the larger issue that you're getting at is this issue of disengaged youth.
Mm-hmm.
And where we are disengaging from family, we are disengaging from church, we are disengaging from those things that historically have been the rocks in our community. And the question is, not so much about how those young people figure out how to connect to them, but how those institutions sort of evolve with the community and evolve with the culture of young people and figure out how to connect to them. I think that we have to begin to realize that that is our priority and should be our obligation.
And does anybody else want to react to that?
Well, you know, I think, again, we say black youth in terms of the last two elections have outvoted other teenagers, other ethnic and racial groups, African-Americans. So I think, again, we're talking about the individuals, how we can move forward individually. But if we don't, I'm telling you, don't really look at this structural, this, you got to read the Coates' piece.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could have these success stories and come here 20 years from now and still say blacks are twice unemployed. We really have to really start thinking about how do we organize a movement to create this equal opportunity, because all of these is a frustration when you have these young people getting college degrees. We know the student loan debt. And they're not getting these jobs. Then they get into these jobs, realize there's a wealth gap, as I found out as I got older, right, that these are some major issues that have an impact on communities, have an impact on families when these things are right. So I think we have to do two things at once. That's what Callie House said, that we can, you know, do two multitask. Yes, we should support individual initiatives, but how do we get this social movement again to change structures, or else you're just going to have this conversation over and over and over, and we shouldn't act surprised.
Eric, did you want to expand on that?
Yeah, well, I always think about the preparation of black people for whatever it is that they should engage in. You know, are there expectations? Are there high standards? Is there rigor being met? Are people being prepared and trained and developed in a way where they can compete? I know Shay and I talk about this a lot. You know, are folks ready to compete for whatever it is out there? And Omar, in his case, he was ready. He wanted to compete for it, and he prepared himself and went to a facility that would rigorously train him for that. Are we doing that? Are we engaging black people in a way, or are black people engaging those things that are in place to get them prepared for that success?
And I think it's also just we're out of time, but it's so important to remember, too, even when that happens, we also have to understand how many impediments there still are. I mean, having been in contact quite a bit recently with this young African-American woman who is totally engaged, and she absolutely believes that she can make it, and she's asking all the right questions, and she's doing all the right groundwork. But I'm just aware of the fact that just because of historic economic inequities, because of everything that's led up to her young life, it's really going to be hard. It's going to be a ton harder, even if some doors open up, even if a really good college says to her, you know what, you could do your last 2 years after you finish community college, do your last 2 years here. She's got to make enough money to support herself. She actually gives some money back to, I think, to her family. It's not going to be that easy. You look around and you think, wow, there must be all these great opportunities, all these great stepladders. And then you realize, wow, yeah, there are, but the people climbing the stepladders are carrying these big, huge sandbags that weigh 25, 35, 45 pounds. Makes it a lot harder to climb. I want to thank everybody who came in here today. Thanks so much to David Canton, Eric Clemens, Shay Dawson, Omar Downer. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks to Betsy Kaplan for pulling the show together. And we'll talk to you tomorrow. Pick it loud and pick it sound.